Cops are sort of punctual creatures by nature, so we're going to get this started as best we can. First of all, thank you for the very robust showing. It's always good to see folks from the district coming out. And I thought what we would do this time around is, obviously this is a forum not so much for me, but it is for you. And I think that one of the lessons learned is that we always have invariably some more questions that are specifically tailored to things that are trending or things that you're seeing or have concerns about reporting specific to the West District. So that's why I bring West District Command staff with me, and we have some of their officers and Lieutenant and Assistant Chief Gaber, who has the South and West Districts under his chain of command. But what we'll do is I'm going to turn it over first of all to Captain Wall, Vic Wall, and I'd like us to first of all address those questions that are specific and unique to the offerings that you may have specific to West, and then you can feast like turkey vultures on me, and we can talk about those citywide issues that I can perhaps shed some light on. So, Captain Wall, why don't you come up here first and give us a, what I think we'd like to do is, if we have a lot of support, frankly, from folks in the West District who were very instrumental in getting us the kickstarted we needed towards getting that Midtown project back on the map and back on a timeline. You know that you are the fifth largest city if you were to secede from the rest of the Union here. And in that respect, you definitely were going to be impacted adversely in terms of the proportionate resources we could bring to bear in a landmass and with this kind of population, 85,000 in this district. So by all means, the Midtown was an appropriate timed response that's well overdue. And I want to talk a little bit, why don't you talk a little bit in a brief sense about what the timeline looks like, and then we'll open it up to their questions.
All right. Thanks, everybody. And I see a lot of familiar faces, but for anyone who doesn't know me, I'm Captain Vic Wall, West District Captain. This is my fifth year as a district captain. And no matter what, my tenure as the current West District Captain will be ending in 2018, because we'll be cut in two pretty much as Midtown opens. So I'll start off with giving a quick update on Midtown, and then I'll hit a few other district updates, and then if people have district-specific questions, I'll be happy to answer them. As I assume everybody in here knows, the budget process last year, thanks to the work of a lot of people in here, we got the Midtown project back in the capital budget for this year and next year moving forward. So the planning is basically, this year is to finish the design process and then start construction in early 2017. So the design process is pretty far along. Captain Lengfeld is sort of leading that charge, and we've actually seen a number of schematics that have different layouts for the property up there on Mineral Point Road. The building that we're gonna try to build is gonna be quite a bit bigger than our current districts. One of the lessons we've learned is that our district stations historically have been pretty much at capacity the day they open, and they're not, haven't been planned for the future, not from our perspective, but we've been pretty much compelled to do that through the city budgeting process. So we're going to try to avoid that this time, and the building will be roughly twice the size as our current West District in terms of square footage. So that should pretty much future-proof it and allow us to really work for the future. The demolition of the current church there, I don't have a perfect answer for when that's going to happen.
Dave Glomp and a few of his shady friends said they'd take sledgehammers to it after the meeting, but I didn't want to hear that.
Yes.
We don't want to hear that.
I think what will probably happen is when the request for the construction and the official proposals go out, the demolition will be worked into that. It's cheaper than demolishing the current property and then sort of mothballing it for a few months before the construction. So I think that current building is probably going to be there until early 2017. It'll be demolished. The new building will be put up. There's a lot of things we've learned from the district stations that we've built, and hopefully we're doing our best due diligence to wrap all those lessons into Midtown so we don't make any of those mistakes again. The community, the neighborhood up there has been really involved to try to make the, as much as a police station can blend into a residential neighborhood, to try to make it look good, look part of the neighborhood, and not really stand out. Parking will hopefully be in the back, so it's not on the main streets. There's a lot of really good design things that have gone into the planning. One of the things we've also been doing as we approach 2018 is talk about logistics and exactly what are the boundaries of Midtown going to be. It's not as easy as you would think to open a police district. You've got to move a lot of cars, radios, lockers, people, and decide how all that happens. So as it kind of looks now, it's not a done deal certainly. South of the Beltline, Whitney Way would kind of be the dividing line between West and Midtown. And then north of the Beltline, Gammon Road would be the dividing line. And then a little bit of what's currently the South District will also come into Midtown, and a little bit of the Central District as well. But mostly West is, about half of the West District will be going into Midtown. Again, we'll check our numbers before January 2018, but that's sort of what we're looking at for the boundaries of Midtown. Our hope is that start of 2018, Midtown is going to open. That's what the plan is. That's what the timetable is. Obviously, there's a lot of things that are unpredictable with construction and the various city processes, but that's what we're gunning for is January 2018, Midtown opens, and then we'll go from 5 districts to 6 districts. So any questions on Midtown specifically or that process? Yes, ma'am.
Could you comment on how you deal with issues at borders? I live near the corner of Regent and Whitney, and I think about once a year there's a crash in the middle of that intersection, which sounds like the line would run through it. So then what?
Well, Badge takes that call.
Just kidding.
If the border is just between one MPD district and another, it hopefully should have very little impact on the citizen, because if an MPD officer shows up and it's an emergency or something needs to get handled, they're going to deal with it. Some of it is just educating dispatchers and making sure that their computer-aided system is properly programmed and everything is built in there. Where it really gets tricky is if it's a border between jurisdictions, between Madison and Middleton or Madison and Fitchburg, because then you've got different agencies showing up and they're saying, this is, you take it, I don't want it, you take it. And that's where it gets tricky. So hopefully if there's any growing pains, they'll be pretty short-lived with it. Any other questions on Midtown or the timeline?
Yes, sir. Do resources stay about the same as far as you're basically taking half your staff and moving it to Midtown, or how is that going to be?
It's a hybrid. It's a combination of some new positions and some existing positions. So for example, patrol officers and patrol resources pretty much are just being reallocated from West and South. But there will be additional commanders that are staffing Midtown. There'll be additional specialized positions like a gang officer, a mental health officer,
neighborhood resource officer,
community policing team. So there will be some additional new MPD positions that are built into the budget that will be staffing Midtown in addition to some reallocation.
Will the number of calls that have historically occurred be taken into account in allocating those resources, because it seems like an awful lot of them come from the area around here?
We have been reviewing data ad nauseum to try to find the best configuration for our district. So not just calls for service, but actual patrol workload has been probably the main measuring stick that we've used. But we will, as I said, we'll continue to do that, because things change from year to year, and we're still about 2 years out. So we will, as this year progresses, continue to look at the data and make sure that we have the borders drawn the wisest way. All right, anything else in Midtown? A couple other quick updates that I just wanted to provide people on the district. What you may have seen if you follow the district blog or Twitter is something that we started 2 weeks ago, Coffee with a Cop. It's certainly nothing that is our idea or that is unique to Madison. There's a lot of police departments across the country that have done it, but it's new to the West District. So Thursdays, 9 a.m., Steep and Brew on Odana Road. If you ever have time and want to stop in, it's very informal. Just patrol officers, most often, occasionally a member of the command staff will be there. Stop in, have coffee, and just have a real informal conversation with an MPD officer. The first 2 weeks were great, had nice turnout, so it's been very positive. We have, as some of you probably saw in the news last year, MPD and the city received a grant, a federal grant, a burn grant, focusing on this area, the southwest side, and actually a much more discrete geographical area. It's a $155,000 grant where we're going to be partnering with Commonwealth, which is a nonprofit, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and a group of other community members, stakeholders. It's primarily a planning grant to come up with a comprehensive plan to reduce crime and increase public safety in this area. The good news is that down the road a little bit, there are a series of action grants that are million-dollar grants that will be awarded by the federal government based on these planning grants. So our hope is that if we can have a good process here, which I'm confident we will, we'll have a good shot at one of those planning grants, which will really bring some funding into the area for public safety and other stakeholders to really try to get at some of the issues out here. So that's we're well underway with that process, or getting started with that process, I guess. Some of you may have seen or heard that we will not have Elder Park fireworks this year. And there's Matt, as if on cue. But we will exchange that event for another major event in the district. June 24th, 5th, and 6th, I think. There's an actual PGA event at University Ridge. I don't know if people have seen that. And University Ridge is actually in the city of Madison, and all the roads around it are in the city. So we're taking a part of that planning process. And I think if you're planning on driving in that area, I would avoid the intersection of M and PD on those 3 days, because that's not a great area on a normal work day. And throw in a golf event and it could be even worse. Two other updates. As you know, every year we do sort of a shift change. So we have some people shuffling the deck in the district and across the city. And probably the most relevant change to you folks is you have a new neighborhood officer, Adam Kneibler. Adam? Anybody who can spell Adam's last name with one try, win a get out of jail free card. So Adam's been working in the area as a patrol officer for the last few years, so he's very plugged into the problems and the issues, and I'm sure a lot of you have met him already, but he's hit the ground running and is, I'm confident, going to do a great job down here in the neighborhood. And then just the final update I'll provide, that some of you probably, just on a specific incident, because it's real noteworthy. You know, residential burglaries have really been a challenge for us, particularly in this area. Last week, our patrol officers arrested a suspect after an attempted burglary. A couple things that highlighted to me, one is that it was a citizen who called in, saw this guy in a backyard trying to kick in a door, and called us right away, so officers were able to get there right away and take him into custody. Turns out that the guy is connected through shoe imprints to potentially a large number of burglaries, maybe a dozen or so. We're still trying to work that out. So that's good news. The bad news, I'd say, is that for the last 6 months, we had charges on this guy in the DA's office waiting to be acted on. So that's a little frustrating, I'm sure, for us as well as for all of you folks, because potentially the guy could have been in custody. But we've impressed upon them the priority to deal with this guy as much as severely as they can, because of the impact he's been having on the neighborhood and public safety. Sir?
Jail right now?
Excuse me?
Is the perpetrator that you called last week in jail right now?
I don't know if he's bailed out or not, to be honest with you. I don't know if he is. He was still in custody. So those are just the updates I wanted to provide. Any other district-specific questions that people have?
I'm from the Dunn's Marsh neighborhood, and we had a rash of burglaries, and someone reported someone, and I think that person was caught, but I never heard anything. You know, he was seen by a neighbor, and the police were called, and he was apprehended. It was a home burglary. We've had a lot of those. That would be like, that would have been on Windflower Way.
Okay.
That's south of Beltline, the Seminole Highway.
It's not ringing a bell to me, okay. so I can't connect the dots on what might have happened with that one, but we try to be able to follow up publicly with some of those kind of cases, because I know people are interested in them, and we do a good job of publicizing the arrest, but not necessarily the next step, so it's something we're going to continue to work on.
In the area might cover the pedestrian safety. It seems like there's a lot of incidents with the crosswalk here, and some people get not stopping and things like that. There's a big emphasis on pedestrian safety, so it seems like just a lot of incidents where people don't get hit by cars.
Right out front here in particular? Yeah, and it's, you know, if you go back 5 years, 4 or 5 years, it was much worse. And I think one of the biggest sort of smart ways we go at these things is through design, and that's why we have the crosswalk and the lights and stuff, and that has really cut down on the issues, at least reported to us. But you know, you all live in Madison and see how people drive in Madison, unfortunately. So it's a tough one for us to solve.
Yeah, talking about how people drive in Madison. I'm going to work today, and I have to give myself an extra half an hour because I have to go on the Beltline, just like the rest of you. And that means at least 2 traffic stops before I get to my destination. So today, in the first time in 32 years, never thought I'd see it, a Prius blows my doors off. A Prius. Now, how can that possibly be? That's an organic, anyway, a Prius. Anyway. By the way, I thought you were going to raise University in Highland. I think last week at that 5 Point there, right by my alma mater, West High, I think we had 3 pedestrians hit within 2 days altogether. So that's really calling for some help. That's where I thought you were going with your question. Yeah, exactly.
I had a question. You were saying that the person that was arrested before, he was out because they were waiting for, what, 6 months for the DA to do something? Why does it, do you know why it takes longer for them to bring him to court? Or?
Well, for them, it's simply a question of resources. And if you look at the number of prosecuting attorneys they have now compared to the 80s, they're down significantly. I mean, they've lost, you know, 30%, I think, of their workforce. They had a lot that were funded through grants and other sort of limited term initiatives. So I forget the exact numbers, but that would be the same as MPD losing 150 police officers. So they just have fewer people, and you know, it's hard. There's only so many hours in the day. So we try to emphasize to them when we can, prioritize this and everything else can stay. But it's it is frustrating because it impacts all of us.
Well, is that something
Well, you know, the dynamic is that district prosecutors are funded through the state and not the county. And if you look at the politics, it's just not likely that they're going to get any extra funding in the foreseeable future, unfortunately. So. Yes, sir.
I have 2 things, and I don't want to forget the first one, so I'm going to go there first, but I want you to address that after I say my other one. So the first one is just, I'm wondering if you could outline what the community officer's kind of responsibilities are in engaging with the community, because I'm a little unclear on that. The second one I just wanted to say, I recently had the opportunity to become involved with some officers through a domestic complaint that we had, and I wanted to just say how well and how wonderful they were. They were from the guy who came initially, the officer who initially responded, through the detectives who followed up the next day. They were great. They were compassionate. They were, they took us seriously, and they followed through on things really well. So I just wanted to say that, to give you that feedback on your officers.
Well, can I just start in the first part about, so we understand, you talk about the neighborhood officers in particular that you want to know more about?
Yes.
Well, first of all, those officers, for those who may not know, literally have to compete for those slots. And they do so because they know, eyes wide open going in, that unlike the normal attribution that we have, attrition that we have through shift pick every year with seniority based, we're asking for a multi-year commitment from them. So they know, eyes wide open, that we need to have that touchstone of familiarity, that they are, for all intent and purposes, going to become the face of MPD, which means that as needs arise, meetings or working with schools or whatever, they're expected to sort of flex those hours to meet the greatest needs or demands of what's trending in their neighborhood. The other thing that's beautiful about the neighborhood office is that they're not call-driven, per se, like a police officer assigned to patrol services. And in that sense, yes, they're cops, they're always going to be cops. Crime prevention, apprehension, prosecution is always going to be a part of what they do. But it is by no means the mainstay. They are just as much about the quality of life issues that they have to deal with, whether it be landlord-tenant issues, whether it be nuisance or abatement things or drug issues or kids just basically with no constructive ways to spend their time after school, and there is nothing that's viable for them and there's a lack of suitable guardianship. They have to sort of start looking at what they can do working in collaboration with other city agencies and not-for-profits about creating things. What the reasons I want to ask about, you know, what they are doing, what their expectations are, is that someone once asked me earlier last week, when do you have a chance to address all 470 cops and your 100 plus civilians? And I said, it's tough because we have five districts, five different shifts. We're literally growing all the time. The calls for service will not be abated. And so at the beginning of the year, I start out with an hour of sort of where I want our heads to be at, as well as subsequent probably video messages, probably once a month where we try to get. And then all of the captains, lieutenants, sergeants, we all believe in the management by walking around concept, meaning you go into the field, you talk to your folks, you ask them, and you go on calls, and you sort of experience what it is that I might be missing by just not being a paper tiger. One of the things that you may have heard about, and I have some handouts for those who are interested in, is in my first year, we really talked about shifting the paradigm or the mindset from that of a warrior mindset to that more of a guardianship, because I think that's truer to the roots of MPD, in that I think that we're about guarding and protecting and defending rights. We're about facilitating quality of life for everyone. We do an awful lot of social work as part and parcel of our job. So don't apologize for it. Embrace it unapologetically. The other thing you've probably heard across the country is this sort of various definitions for what I'll call the Ferguson effect. Rightly after Ferguson, you had a lot of agencies where they came out, the officers did, and basically took what I, with all due respect to my people in fire sciences, a firehouse mentality in terms of servicing calls, meaning we stay bunkered and cloistered in the station, you get the call for service, you handle the call, you get back in the car, you go back and you wait for the next one. You expose yourself to as minimal sort of exposure of complaints or concerns or any of that other stuff. Well, when we saw that happening across the country as a phenomenon, we had a sort of a come to Papa meeting, and we said, listen, we are not going to be anything like the Ferguson effect. When others are recessing or going into those cocoons, now more than anything, folks, I'm challenging our workforce to park the cars and to get out into the community even more so, because I'm firmly convicted it's those one-to-one, one call, one contact, one transaction, one encounter at a time, authentically, is what's going to win back the hearts and minds of those who have some concerns about where policing has gone nationally and where it is in Madison. So I have sort of a mantra that everywhere you go in the department, I always want folks to police like a champion. And when people ask me to further refine or hone those, they say, sure, there's four elements that are constantly seamlessly working their way in to the way we relate to others. There's an engagement, there's a relational element, there's the listening, and then explaining better what we do, when we do, and why we're doing it. Because as a consumer of services, I don't want you to be mystified about what we're doing on any given call, and I want you to have that information. And again, I go out and flesh it out more, and we talk about these things for a full hour, because at the end of the day, I don't want us to be traditional law enforcement. I want us to be proactive, preemptive, collaborative, and at a very grassroots level, willing to talk about what those issues are above and beyond crime. Lieutenant Mike Hansen was here earlier, and he had me come to a neighborhood forum just like this a couple of months ago on an Allied Drive. So of course, I was primed. I was ready for my shots fired data, gang violence, heroin, you name it. We spent the entire time talking about landlord-tenant issues, trials and tribulations, because out there, that's the quality of life issue that rocks their world. Or where it doesn't happen, or where there's dissonance between what the landlord's expectations are and what tenants are talking about. So I have long since learned to understand that when we come to forums like this, I try to prep on a lot of stuff, but frankly, it's the day-to-day things in life that have this sort of aggregation factor, a cumulative factor, if you will, that really weighs and presses upon our psyche. And we don't want to ignore that, and we don't want to ignore our role as police officers in addressing that. So I didn't mean to steal your opportunity for the neighborhood officer, but that goes to sort of neighborhood officers throughout the city, which is why in my first budget process, when I first started as chief, you know, we literally polled 5 district captains. And I said, hey, this is my first budget, my first rodeo. And all I know is that I really believe that relational policing is best done in the crucible known as our neighborhoods. But I'm not going to ask for something unless I can defend its use. So if you don't mind, submit to me any and all prospects where you think that you have neighborhoods that are maybe on a slow simmer. They might be percolating a little bit, and you might think you might need some responsive and timely addressing to that. Well, he was one of 5 captains who submitted no less than 8 neighborhoods. Now, if you go to the City of Madison website, there's a total of 125 registered neighborhoods. So when you have 5 commanders saying, we have almost a third of the neighborhoods in Madison, that gives us some pause, that has always been sort of my impetus. I've told you folks, because I've seen a lot of regulars here, we need to win on two fronts, or where our community's next future lies in terms of best of list, quality of list for everyone. Those two fronts are what's going on at MMSD, because as go the fortunes of the schools, so goes the fortunes of our communities. And when you have 28,000 students registered and almost 50% by the district's count are living in poverty, that's a problem. That's a problem. Particularly when the cyclical problems of education, in the sense that we have about 7,500 students who represent a demographic of color, for want of a better word, and over 70%, according to the district, of those are qualifying for federal subsidies for breakfast and lunch. So it does have disproportionate impact, even in the educational domain. A very good friend of mine, a colleague, Dr. Floyd Rose, 100 Black Men, he says, Chief, I've been on the circuit 100 times thereover. Everybody from MMSD is there, and they haven't disputed the fact that I said we only have about 500 to 700 of our kids of color that are reading at grade level. And we have high dropout rates, kids not achieving or succeeding leads to what? Economic problems, right? An untrained or unskilled growing population looking or desperate for work and opportunities, and they don't have the capacity to even fill out the applications or things like that. That then cycles into other things. Desperate people owing to desperate measures. There's a finite amount of places that you can afford to live in Madison, and that's putting additional stressors on some of those neighborhoods. So often is the fact, regrettably, I feel like MPD at some point in this educational and economic morass is sort of like, clean up aisle 6. We get there when, frankly, all these other combined systems have failed at one octave or another. And now we have to deal with the observable, articulable behavior that is arguably in contradiction to state laws, city ordinances. And how do we try to reconcile that? We can do so much with restorative justice initiatives, and we're doing more and more. You know, we launched this last fall in September. We had taken a look internally at how many kids, particularly kids of colors, are getting ordinance violations. We looked at the previous year, over 800 tickets. Over 75% of those are kids of color. It's unacceptable. We got to find other ways to deal with these behaviors. So we launched last September 23rd. All 12 to 16-year-olds who get a ticket from the City of Madison Police, you can go one of two routes. You can go the conventional route and pay a ticket, or the parents pay a ticket, and that's about the sum total, or you can avoid that outcome altogether. You can go through this portal and volunteer and sign up for peer court, time bank, restorative justice outcomes. And you fulfill those mandates, and then you don't, the ticket goes away. So we're trying to do some innovative things here that do our part to show we have to measure up too in dealing with these disparities that confront us. So my whole thing has always been, as the chief, is that schools and neighborhoods will ultimately define what we're going to see from our community in the next decade. Questions? The last time we,
In the last meeting at
Tokay,
I asked you a question about whether police lie to people, and you gave an instance of someone who was about to be either murdered or seriously wounded. I hadn't thought of that angle. The thrust of my question was, will the police lie to civilians that they're questioning under more mundane circumstances, like, I saw you come out of that barn, or I saw you empty your ashtray in the parking lot?
Okay, well, there's legal considerations about what a police officer can or cannot do. Obviously, if a police officer is in an undercover capacity, the courts have held that based on that public policy rationale, lying is permissible to a point, right, if you're an undercover, or if you are, in fact, involved in some sort of coercive, co-optive hostage negotiation in order to meet that peace. But no, in the norm, lying in and of itself, while it has some judicial authorization, it's not the first default of how you deal with people. It's not a preferred best practice.
So Madison Police won't lie unless it's a matter of life and death?
Well, I don't know if I'd ever say won't lie, because we've already talked about drug transactions. I don't know that those are life or death. We have UC officers who will lie about who they are and what their motives are.
I'm referring to officers in uniform.
Officers in uniform should not, as a matter of form, be lying. No. Okay? Other questions? Well, today was sort of a bad day for me. Today I got word that our lawsuit with respect to asking for a declaratory judgment to open up Mendota Mental Health for our emergency detention petitions was denied. So, as a result of that bad news, of course, we're sort of rallying, myself and the city attorneys and his staff, to see whether, in fact, looking at the 8-page opinion from the court, whether there is some basis to appeal. As you know, we have seen time and time again more and more resources being dedicated to folks who are, quite frankly, falling between the cracks of a sort, having mental illness, episodic breaks or crises. Typically, from the time we first contact someone in the throes of that desperation, it's well over an 8-hour investment on average, taking two officers. Just to sort of review with you folks, what happens is that a lot of times the police are called to behavior which would otherwise be in conflict with state statute, like disorderly conduct or breaking somebody's window. So we see sort of that overt manifestation, if you will, of a crime. However, once we get there, when the officer has a chance to sort of assess, engage, look at the totality of those circumstances, more often than not, those officers are also trained to see that there is something not quite right here. The affect is off. A capacity to string together biographical questions that you and I would take for granted come with some degree of difficulty. So clearly what we would do in that instance, again, we probably have probable cause for an underlying crime, but moreover, we're going to take that person under our protective custody and take them to a hospital for a medical evaluation and clearance. There could be that something's going on physiologically that doesn't meet the eye that could probably be understood by a practitioner. Then what we also do is that we collaborate with Dane County Mental Health, but specifically the arm we use is Journey Mental Health. And they basically have street workers assigned. And we'll do a phone consult, and then ultimately, hopefully, there'll be a collaborative mix at the ER. And again, when you're in an ER, hope none of you get there, but I was visiting an employee who had slipped and fallen on Friday. She got to the ER at UW at noon, and she was still there when I was done at 4, waiting to be seen. So we wait in the same line. It's a triaging sort of system, right? So by the time we get that assessment done, of course, when you're dealing with Chapter 51 matters of mental illness, the paradigm is, what is the path of least resistance? What's the least restrictive alternative that we can do in terms of bringing this person into the fold of what's helpful, right? Well, obviously, our first druthers would be is that if they could possibly get a self-admittance or voluntary admission to one of the local hospitals, that's obviously what we would look for. That would be optimal. But frankly, a lot of these hospitals either A, are filled or will not take or do not have the capacity to offer a secure environment if there's some volatility with this particular patient. So we're trying to explore all things short of an involuntary petition. But sometimes if you have that mental illness prong coupled with a sort of an imminent threat to self or others to do harm, that is sort of the two-prong test in a nutshell of what we're looking for a petition for an emergency detention. And that's not filed with the criminal court. That's ultimately going to go to a probate court because this is not a criminal process, right? Okay. So by the time medical clearance, the assessment, the collaboration, the trying to work the system as best we can, it may come to an ED, an emergency detention, in which case then, owing to liability issues, the only person that can make those conveyances, because we've explored it with our city attorney, are law enforcement, because we have not relinquished our care, custody, and control of that protective custody or relationship. So that means we have to go to Winnebago in Oshkosh. And that's 2.5 hours one way to do the intake, and then another 2.5 hours to get back. And so my quandary has been and is always going to be is that on many levels, first of all, let's start with that which is most important, the individual self-affected. We should actually have Adam go and pull a squad car over and just see how much leg room and creature comforts you think you have in the back seat of that squad car going 2.5 hours like this. Because of the protected cage, not meant for those sort of long-term conveyances, and we don't have the capacity to designate some vehicles with or without. It's inefficient. So then you're taking two officers out of your beats for at least 5 hours. Remember, from the time of contact to the time of resolution, they're back is usually an overtime call in excess of 8 hours. So nowhere was this brought home more fundamentally and sadly, was this past summer in, I believe it was June or July, when I got a text from our officers who thought they were being cute by sending me a little text message of a photo of them. And I have bad eyes and too vain to wear them, and it was a dark lip, Great Dane, and I probably had a beer. So my wife said, they keep calling you. So I looked, I said, okay, I'm going to get the glasses out, go to the bathroom where I can see something. And they had assembled in front of the Winnebago health facility there, mental health facility. There were 4 squads with 8 Madison cops. Because in one shift, they had to do 4 separate ED conveyances. I can't tell you, that's probably about, on any good shift, that's about a third of our workforce on a shift, not even 2.5 hours from here. So those are the concerns that remain unabated, but I'm trying to find some lemonade out of all these lemons. I will say that for those who had a chance or can access, we then decided that we cannot wait for the state, nor can we wait for the county to try to find a money tree to help us. So we told each district captain that they would have to cinch their belts and go with one less police officer assigned to patrol services, which nobody likes. Patrol services, just so we know, there's a lot of keen things on TV, CSI every 10 minutes, Law and Order every 15, they're sort of on the passe now. All these detectives, and they're wonderful. All of these specialized units are great, but patrol brings home the bacon. 70% of contacts, where hearts are won or lost, 70% of contacts in this nation of ours are rooted in patrol services. How? Well, either you were pulled over like the Prius this morning, I hope it was positive for her, she did get a ticket, so that was her experience for the next 5 years, or you're a victim, a witness, a complainant, someone involved with a call, okay? So for us, you know, we need to make sure that patrol is not diminished, because that's the folks you're counting on when you dial 911. But the beauty of having started these five district officers to do nothing but mental health calls, preemptive, collaborative, working with providers and making providers work, they've probably deterred, my goodness, hundreds of calls. If you look at their annual report, they've taken on numerous of these EDs, and more importantly, they have found mechanisms to avert or prevent these calls from getting to the patrol officers. So they've actually been very cost effective as well as more humane in terms of the time constraints that they don't face like a police officer sent to patrol does. So I'm trying from all of that to suggest that in Madison, as we continue to grow, more and more you're going to hear me here and everywhere talking about, what are you willing to pay for? What is going to be a priority as we move forward in community? And the reason I ask this is that there's about, remember about 25, 30 years ago, we all sort of had a similar conversation foisted upon us. It was called HMOs. What are essential services? What are extraneous services that you're going to have to pay more for? I think that we're very blessed here in Madison that we have managed, through some very creative cops, we have managed to work smarter, and we have provided BOKU, what I always call premium cable services, because that's somebody we can all relate to and despise. Right? There's your basic static cable. And some cities will give you that. They handle the call, end the call, and wait for the next call. When you find a Madison Police Department doing neighborhood policing, community policing teams which can be dynamically moving around to meet those needs as they're emerging, gang intervention officers, educational resource officers, safety education officers, mental health officers, we're offering a lot of stuff you're not going to find anywhere else for a comparably sized community as our size. Now, the reason this becomes more relevant, folks, is that we are now the 83rd largest city, according to, of course, the infamous Wikipedia. So it's got to be right. But what we're seeing trending, I just saw the mayor kicked me another top 10 for something list, top 10 destination for U-Haul or something, I think I just got from him. So he's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs on these lists, I'm telling you. Right, Alder? Don't answer that. You might have to work with him. I'm insulated from Chapter 62, so I can speak a little more freely than you. So the bottom line is that there's no doubt but that the quality of life that we do enjoy, We do enjoy a good, healthy quality of life, but if we want to preserve it, if we want to expand it, and if we want to have those lists applied to more than those of us who are privileged to have that opportunity economically, then we're going to have to make some tough discussion points happen in community as a community in terms of that. You'll probably see, because the budgeting process has been pushed upwards now, is that there's going to be some rigorous discussions. I get a little animated, so does he. That always makes for good fireworks. My mom doesn't like that side of me. She wishes she could only hear it on radio. But at the end of the day, this department has not grown its police department commensurate to the size of this community. I'm just going to say it. We've had four different staffing committees over the past 20 years. And in each and every one of those staffing committees, three of them were staffed by mayor's office, alders, comptrollers, city of Madison, and union membership. In three out of those four studies, they all came to the same conclusion: Madison is understaffed, comparable to the services you want to provide relative to the communities that you are similar to. We provide a lot of services you don't see offered elsewhere. And the fourth study that was done in 2007-2008, the city paid over $60,000 for to get an independent set of eyes on this very subject. It was the Etico study, and they came to the same conclusion that we are understaffed. And quite frankly, our ratio per thousand, which is one of the FBI indices and the Bureau of Justice Assistance, they have communities much larger and much smaller than ours that has higher ratios. We're at a 1.87 per thousand. Because I knew there'd be numbers in this junk, I decided to look at some comparables, and I don't want to be misquoted here. So, nationwide, for cities 250,000 and over, nationwide, it's 2.6 per thousand. Remember, I said we're at a 1.87. The Midwest, as a region for communities over a quarter of a million, is at a 3.0. We're at a 1.87. The East and North Central Midwest is at a 3.3. West North Central Midwest is at a 2.3. Minneapolis is at 2.07 per thousand. St. Paul, 2.1. St. Louis, 4.35. Milwaukee, 3.15. Baltimore, 4.46. So, one of the studies in 2003 said we ought to be at least at a 2.0 by now. We're at a 1.87. We're actually backsliding. So, if in fact that is my marching orders, we will continue because we are committed. We have skin in this game to make this community robust. We will do as best we can with the resources that were provided. But I'm telling you that was going to become increasingly more difficult. And a lot of the things that these ratios don't encounter and have never encountered, I can tell you that in 1983, when I started as a cop in Madison, we did not spend over 8 hours on a mental health call. And now when you look at our statistics from last year, about 70% of our calls that involved multiple units were a mental health call. I can tell you that in 1983, I wasn't administering naloxone to pulseless non-breathers who have overdosed in a lot of Woodmans. Didn't happen. I can tell you, in spite of what some of my mentors have said, that there was never a period of time in my career where in the span of 35 days there were over 30 separate shots fired calls in this city. So there are those. Nico, do you want to leave the room? Because you're not responsible for Chris Rickard. There are those who have said, what is Madison belly aching about? They're at a 1.84. My gosh. Look at McFarland. Look at Verona. We am not McFarland. Verona, and the bedrooms. Come on, folks. There's a young man back there, but there was a quote, young man. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. I'm not going to go into this mining and cross-pollination of statistics. I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you. Not going to ask elected officials. I'm going to ask you, especially you, who are career Madisonians. You think Madison feels as safe as everybody else tells me it feels? I didn't think so. And yet I'm told that I'm a fear-mongerer. Well, to each his own. I can tell you, because I've been a cop here since 1983, I did not hear alert tones 2 and 3 times in an 8-hour shift. I saw an alert tone 2 or 3 times in 6 days. And for someone to suggest that officer safety is much ado about nothing, and that, what was the quote?
Oh, yes.
Commercial fishermen and lumberjacks are at higher risk than police officers today. I'm sure that's some small solace to the young woman who was commissioned on Friday and was killed on Saturday in her first night. I'm sure her parents will wonder about whether their daughter would have been better off being attacked by a tree or a tuna. I'm sorry, folks. I can't abide by politicians telling me that I'm all off base and that this city has never been safer. Is this the same Meadowood that I drove through 10 years ago? No. Come on, people.
No.
No.
No way.
Of course not. Don't let them tell you it is. I like people to be real with me. That's all I'm asking. Just be real. And if at the end of the day, you speak with the budgetary purse, and if you don't want that to happen, that's fine. My officers are going to still chase calls. We're going to still put it all on the line. We're still going to do everything we can to make this city better. But when you're waiting and you're concerned about the timeliness of our response, or if it looks like we're feeling rushed as we service those calls, you send them to me. Because I'm warning you, we cannot continue to placate our egos and to suggest that Madison is manifestly no different than it was when I started here as a cop. That's poppycock. Come on. Don't insult the people who serve this city. My cops. On a lighter note, we did get another grant for 600 more doses of naloxone. For that, I'm very grateful. Although, with good comes bad, this is now being laced with fentanyl and other additives, which now means that what we typically could have done with one dose is requiring between 2 and 4 administrations now. It's become that virulent. Last week, Friday night, I get called every time there's a officer injured or a significant crime occurring in our city. We literally at the Motel 6 had 2 sisters. One sister goes out for heroin, gives it to her other sister. Other sister overdoses and dies, and the kids are playing in the tub in the bathroom while all this drama unfolds. I wish I could say that that was an anomaly. I can't. The 8-hour updates in this city will make you cry. We've literally been going on and on with this one family, and I'll get to you in a minute, miss. And our officers have taken temporary custody of their 3-year-old 3 times now in the last 6 months. It's like a revolving door with CPS. So these are very real life stories that you don't have to go to Chicago or Milwaukee or the Twin Cities. This is our city. These are our problems. This is our community. And we need to understand what is it our priorities are going to be in meeting out quality of life standards for everyone. Yes, ma'am.
I just want to know,
Well, we will have to look at the possibility of a Len Bias type of charge if it was proven that she was contributing, but quite frankly, I'd really like to get the source of the heroin more than I'd even her as a conduit. But that'll have to be for the district attorney's office to evaluate once we get them all the facts. Our drug gang task force is still compiling that evidence. So that could be an exposure, but again, it sort of begets my bigger question is, the brick and mortar solution has done nothing to deter or deflect the levels of addiction that this country and this county have experienced. Quite frankly, I'm not sure that some mechanism of treatment with high degree of monitoring wouldn't be more cost effective and have at least some opportunity for better outcomes than just warehousing people. You know, we were talking about mental health earlier. Usually don't like to give the guys in brown a break, Mahoney.
We like them.
I love them. We're like brothers. We fight all the time. No. I feel for Dave because I would like to be able to say here, without lying, I would be able to say that each and every officer, when they encounter someone's doing something wrong or contrary to state statute, would do a comprehensive analysis to ensure that this person is acting out of a mental illness rationale or reasoning, root cause. But at what point, when you've done this so often as our officers have done this, at what point is it a little bit tempting to say, that's disorderly conduct. Whatever you say, that's disorderly conduct. I'm going to book him into jail. And I'll be back on the street and serving my beat in my community in 45 minutes. That's testing the fates. That's testing fate. Because that's a short-term turnaround. And I'll bet you if Dave were here, I know he'd say that 45% of his incarcerated people are suffering from mental illness and or addiction. I know he would. He wants to do the right thing. He wants to find a more humane way to deal with these things too. I've heard him lobby on the stump for that. Do you have a question, young man? By the way, thank you for excellent door service. I feel very secure. You bet.
I've been like kid police for almost a lot of years, so never put anybody in jail.
Well, that's very good. That would be all of our best case scenario. Look for ways not to put people in jail. You know, it's funny that you should mention that. I just got a letter today from the Dean of Students of Engagement at East High, who sent me what I consider to be profound. He had seen a student reported stealing an $800 iPad, and they had the kid on camera, and he turned it over to my educational resource officer, Officer Zuma Franco. And he then described how Zuma arranged for a meeting with him and the affected student. And they had a meeting in which the student started out extremely defensive, did not want to talk to the cop, vented vociferously, started denying before we even said what he was charged with. And then she was very plain and matter of fact, hey, listen, here's what I know. We have a picture of you. The picture's quite good, and I'll show it to you. And you're taking this iPad without the consent of the student who owns it. That's a theft. Now, having said that, let's talk about how we can look at this differently. Three sessions later, he returns the iPad in the same pristine condition he got it. He's now having a relationship with the police that he's never had before, and he he apologized to the student that he stole it from. I talk to my officers all the time. We talk about BPR, best possible resolutions, which should go beyond the pale of tickets and arrests.